Well, good morning, everybody. How's everybody doing this morning? It's good to see you all. I know that we felt a few raindrops, right? And how many people pulled out their phone and you're like, I gotta check the weather app. I think we're gonna be okay. So we'll just settle in and pray that God holds off the rain till later this afternoon. So when I was in college, I went into college as an athletic training major. I grew up playing sports and thought some sort of career in sports would be great to keep that going. And so I thought athletic training would be a good option for me. And so my first year of school, I took anatomy and physiology, I took exercise science, I took kinesiology, all these great classes, and I loved all of the coursework. But as I moved on through that first year, I came to realize that the next 3 years of my program were gonna be wildly committed to sports at school, meaning we had to, as trainers, be basically on three or four sports teams for the remainder of your college career. And the commitment that trainers had was actually a little bit higher than the athletes, because you had to show up an hour to an hour and a half early before practice started to help prep some of the athletes who needed work. You would be there all through practice, and then you had to stay an hour and a half after practice to help rehab athletes. So the commitment level was huge, and I was starting to calculate, you know, I didn't love the work to the degree that the commitment was necessary. So I was like, I don't want to go through 4 years of school just like begrudging this degree and then get to the end and be like, I wish I would have done something different. So at the end of my first year, I changed my major. I went from athletic training to communication with an emphasis in public speaking, and that's where God started to call me into the ministry. Now, with this shift came a course requirement that I was not excited about, because I moved from like a BS to a BA. I had to now take foreign language, and I hated foreign language. I was terrible. I went through 3 years of Spanish in high school, and the only thing I could say coming out of 3 years of Spanish was puedo ir al baño. Can I go to the bathroom? Like, that was it. Like, that was all I could remember. That was all I could gather. I was terrible at it. And I realized, I got to take a foreign language class. So I sucked it up. I took Spanish that first semester of my sophomore year. I got to the end of that year, and I was so relieved that, I got this out of the way. I got this done. Until I realized the requirement wasn't one semester of foreign language, it was a whole year of foreign language. I was like, I've got to do that all over again. This is going to be a disaster. And so I was really discouraged, really frustrated, until I learned that in the foreign language department, they offered sign language as a foreign language. And I was like, that's amazing. Because I actually grew up with deaf grandparents, and I couldn't communicate with them all that well, because we didn't see them all that often. I'm like, I could really impress them. I'll take a sign language class. I'll go visit them, and they'll be like, my grandson is amazing. I just like, this is going to be great. So I got really excited about it. I registered for my courses, and then my advisor called me into his office. They called you in at the end of every year just to like check, hey, how's next year going? You make sure you're on track. And so we sat down. I gave him my schedule. He's like, okay, I see all this, and I see that you've signed up for sign language, which is great. I was like, yeah, and I told him why I was all excited about it. And he's like, great, wonderful. Just so you know, that won't count as your foreign language credit. I was like, what do you mean? It's like in the foreign language department. He's like, yeah, it's not gonna count. And I'm like, why? He says, because technically sign language isn't a foreign language. And I said, says who? And he's like, me. And the university, it doesn't count. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. So I went back and forth with him. We must have had like a 15-minute conversation, and I was convinced I was going to change his mind, but I didn't. I walked out of that meeting so infuriated. It's like, I'm going to write the dean of students. I'm going to call a petition. I'm going to protest this. I was all up in arms about it. So I went, and he made me redo my schedule, and we had one more meeting, and I came back again, and I was like, you know, please, I was begging him, pleading with him. He's like, sorry, you can take sign language. He's like, I'm not saying you can't take sign language. It just won't count towards your foreign language credit. And at the end, I finally submitted and took Spanish for another year. Now, in all of those interactions, what I wasn't recognizing and what I was actually pushing against was that it was my advisor in the school who had the authority to tell me how my degree was going to play out. And what I wanted was to set the course myself. And I forgot to realize, or I failed to realize, that they were the ones that actually had the authority. And my role as a student there was to come under that authority. And authority is a reality in our world that everybody will bump up against at some point. Right? Like if you're a student, it's your teacher who has the authority. And if your teacher says, read 3 chapters in your book and there's going to be a test at the end of the week, guess what? There's going to be a test at the end of the week. If you're an employee, it's your employer who has the authority. And if your employer says, hey, I need you to work extra hours this week, well, you're going to work extra hours that week. And if you're a student, or excuse me, a child, it's your parent who has the authority. And if your parents say, hey, you can't go out with your friends tonight, guess what? You're staying in. And even if we like those who have authority over us, our culture has this negative perception of authority. Because our culture has this deep value of freedom, and we are suspect of those who might threaten our freedom. And if they do, we are ready to go all William Wallace on them, right? Remember William Wallace from Braveheart? That scene at the end of the movie where he's rousing the troops and he's saying, they may take our lives, but they will never take our freedom. And our culture has that value embedded into it. Now, the way that our culture defines freedom is I can do what I want. I can do what I want, and nobody can tell me otherwise. Like, that's how we as Americans tend to define freedom. But the question is that how the Bible defines freedom? Does the Bible define freedom as you can do whatever you want? Or does the Bible define freedom as doing and living out who you are the way that God designed you? And one area of authority that is wildly emotionally charged in our culture is politics. Anybody want to talk about politics this morning? Any takers? I'm seeing people like, no, please, let's not go there. Yes, you want to go there? Well, guess what? Romans 13 goes there. We're living in a time when the political climate is intensely polarized and divisive. And for many, the perception is, depending on who's in office, my freedoms and my rights might be in jeopardy. And so it raises the question, what is the role of authority, you could even say political authority, in our life? And as Christians, how are we supposed to respond to it, right? Because guess what? We're coming up on another presidential election. It's going to get heated. So how do we, as Christians, live in light of that? That's exactly what Paul is speaking to in Romans 13. This is what he says. Let everyone be subject to the governing authorities. Now, if the subject of politics wasn't already emotionally charged enough, the idea of submission in that conversation only ups the ante. Because there aren't too many words in our culture that make people bristle like the word submit or submission. Because if our culture values freedom, and we define freedom as I can do what I want, the notion of submitting to anyone is incongruent with that value. Now, Paul here, though, isn't saying you blindly submit to people in authority. He actually gives reason why. He goes on to say, for there is no authority except which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. That's Romans 13, verse 1. So the reason governing authorities have authority is because God has granted it to them. And Jesus says something very similar. In John 19, he says something very similar when he is with Pilate. He's been arrested by the Jewish council. He's been tried before the Jewish Sanhedrin. He's been then turned over to Pilate, and Pilate is trying to figure out what in the world is going on. They're claiming that this guy says he's the Son of God. They're claiming that he says he's the true king of the Jews. And they're submitting him to Pilate saying, hey, there is no king except for Caesar. This guy is trying to start an insurrection. And so they bring him to Jesus. And Pilate is trying to sort all of this out, trying to understand, why are they bringing him? Who is this guy? Who does he think he is? And so at the end of it all, he hears these people saying, crucify him, crucify him, crucify him. And Pilate goes to Jesus trying to sort this out because Jesus is giving him all of these cryptic answers. And he says, don't you realize that I have the power to free you or crucify you? And Jesus responds saying, you would have no power over me if it weren't given to you from above. Meaning, it's God who has given you this authority. Implication: we are called to surrender to governing authorities, and in doing so, we surrender and submit to God, which means the reverse is true. If we resist, if we push back against governing authorities, we are rebelling against God. That's what Paul goes on to say in verse 2. Consequently, whoever rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. Paul is saying that the reality of governing authority has been put in place by God. Therefore, submission to that authority is submission to God, and resistance against that authority is resistance to God. Now, not only does Paul speak to the reality of governing authority, he also speaks to the purpose of it. He goes on to say this in verse 3. For rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. Do you want to be free from fear of the one in authority? Then do what is right, and you will be commended. I can remember when I was in high school, sitting in class one day. It was the beginning of class, and the phone in the classroom rang, and the teacher goes over there, she picks it up, and she goes, uh-huh, yep, uh-huh. And then she says, yeah, he's here. And she looks right at me. And I'm like, oh no. And she goes, and she's looking at me going, uh-huh, uh-huh, I'll send him down right away. She hangs up the phone and she goes, Brian, you need to go to the principal's office. And there's like this collective gasp in the room. Like, what happened? So I sheepishly get up from my desk, walk down the hall, and all of these thoughts are turning over in my mind. Like, did I do something wrong? Did I skip class? Did I get into a fight? Did I cheat on a test? What, I mean, and I can't think of anything that I've done wrong. So I walk into the principal's office, and they say, hey, good news, you've been nominated for some award or whatever. And I was like, oh, what a relief. But the reality was I shouldn't have even needed to fear, because I knew that I didn't do anything wrong, because when you follow in line with the authority that God has placed for you, you don't have to worry or be afraid. Paul is saying if we don't need to live in fear, we don't need to worry about submitting to authority, because we're living in the way that God has called us to live. And Paul is saying the purpose of authority is this. For this is verse 4. For the one in authority is God's servant for your good. God puts people in authority for the good of the community, and if you're going along with it, there's nothing to fear. He goes on to say, but if you do wrong, be afraid, for rulers do not bear the sword for no reason. He's saying authorities are there for the purpose of justice and righteousness. They are called to put into place things that are right and proper. He goes on to say, they are God's servants, agents of wrath, and to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. God is a God of justice. God wants justice in our world. And so the authorities that are in place are put there to ensure that injustice is stopped. So Paul is saying the purpose of authority is to essentially maximize the good and put in place for good. They're called to minimize evil and administer justice to stop evil. And they're also put in place to ensure order over chaos, because God is a God of order. Like, you see that in the creation account, right? God creates everything, and he brings order out of chaos, and he creates this good, beautiful world, and then he puts humanity in that world to steward his good, ordered creation. But it's after the fall that things start to go sideways. Because the first thing that happens after sin enters the world is that Cain kills Abel, right? And right after that, you have this story of Cain having a grandson named Lamech. And Lamech has this mantra, if Cain is avenged seven times, Lamech is avenged 77 times. Essentially, I'm going to do what I want. Like, I'm going to live the way that I want, and I'm going to enact revenge on whoever I see fit. And from there, you have this spiral downward. God created this good, beautiful world full of peace and shalom. Sin enters the world, and then there's this spiral downward to destruction. And then you find it kind of comes to a culmination in Genesis 6. Genesis 6, verse 5, where the writer of Genesis says that every inclination, every thought of the human heart was only evil all the time. Things were not good at all. And so God creates a good world that's ordered, filled with equity and justice, but because of sin, humanity is quick to become their own judge and administer their perception of justice however they see fit. They're their own judge and juror. And as you keep working through the Old Testament, you get to the book of Judges. And the book of Judges is one of the darkest, bleakest, despairing books in the Old Testament. It's full of insurrection, it's full of rage, it's full of, you know, violence, it's full of people getting impaled through their head with stakes, it's people assassinating kings, and you get to the end of Judges. And this is the mantra through the book of Judges, and it's the last verse that captures perfectly this idea of because of sin, we become our own judge and juror. It says, in those days, Israel had no king. This is the last verse of the book of Judges. In those days, Israel had no authority. There was no one ruling. There was no one governing. And everyone did as they saw fit. Some translations say, everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And I think if we're honest with ourselves, sometimes we do the same. Sometimes we think, no. I'm in charge. I do what I want. I have freedom. Nobody is going to tell me what to do. And maybe you're not out there trying to start an insurrection, right? Maybe you're not out there trying to overthrow some king. But even in little ways, I think this mindset of like, I do what I want, and nobody can tell me what to do, is found in our everyday moments of life. So this was a couple years ago, and I was at the zoo with my kids. This is a map of one area of the zoo. It was a Sunday afternoon. It was just me and the three kids, and we were at the hippos, which if you see this purple star, that's where the hippos were. If you've been to the Milwaukee Zoo, you might be able to like place yourself in this part. We were looking at the giraffes, and it's like, hey, let's go see the hippos. We spent a few minutes looking at the hippos, and then from there, I was like, hey, let's go to the big cats, go see the lions and the tigers and all that. And so you walk through this little courtyard, and there's the big cat exhibit. So we go through this courtyard, and there's this entrance in the courtyard into the big cat exhibit where the red star is. Can we see that red star? Yeah. And now, this was in the middle of the pandemic, so it was probably early 2021. And so one of the things that places were doing, specifically the zoo, was they were trying to move traffic in one direction, right? That we didn't have people crossing each other. So certain exits and entrances were marked clearly as either an entrance or an exit. Now, typically in non-pandemic times, that entrance was an entrance, also an exit. You could go right in. And so we walk up to that, and there's this sign on the door that says exit only. And I'm like, exit only, come on. Like, what do you want me to do? Like, if I'm gonna go all the way, like, in order to get into the big cat exhibit, they were saying you had to go all the way past the hippos again, around where the rhinos are, up to the north end of the big cat exhibit and walk in. I'm like, I'm going to have to go walk a quarter mile just to go see the big cats. And I'm standing there. All of this conversation is happening in my head for what feels like 2 minutes. It was probably 5 seconds. And I say, forget it. I'm going in the exit. So I go to grab the door, and before I can grab the door, it swings open, and out comes this dad pushing a stroller, and he says, it's an exit only, you have to go around. And I was like, who do you think you are to tell me what to do? And I was furious. I mean, like, my kids saw this, and they could see the anger flare up. And my daughter's like, Dad, are you okay? Like, for another hour, I'm fuming. Like, again, who does this guy think he is? Like, nobody can tell me what to do. If I want to go in and exit, I'm going to go in and exit. I think we ended up walking around that day and went to the north side of the exhibit. But even in little ways, we see this thing work in our heart. Like, I'm the master of my own destiny. I don't have to submit to anyone, let alone any authority that God has put in place. But Paul says this in verse 5. Therefore, you must submit. You must submit to governing authorities, not only because of wrath, not just to keep your nose clean, he's saying, but also because of your conscience. You should have some conviction, he's saying, about submitting to governing authorities. Now, if you're dialed in to what I've said for the last 10, 15 minutes, this probably raises all sorts of questions for you. It probably also makes you a little uncomfortable too, right? You're like, oh, I hate talking about politics. I hate talking about politics, especially while I'm away on retreat at camp, right? And you're probably thinking, Brian, are you saying that the Bible is saying that every governing leader is like hand-picked and chosen by God for such a time as this? Like, is that true of Putin? Like, and you're saying that Paul says that governing leaders are God's servants. Like, does Putin think that about himself? Do all other governing leaders think that about themselves? Do they see themselves that way? And some Christians will say that, especially if the candidate that they want to get in office gets in office, that person was ordained by God, is what they will say, right? They will say, that person was ordained by God. It's like, really? Is that really true? And it could be kind of scary when you think about it. Because what if they're a bad leader? And history is full of bad leaders. Think of Hitler. Think of Stalin. See, the same thing that's at work in my heart about going in an exit-only door, right, is called pride. And pride exists in all of our hearts. And just because a leader may be chosen by God, if we could even actually verify that, it doesn't mean that they are exempt from pride. It doesn't mean that they are exempt from thinking too highly of themselves. It doesn't mean that all of a sudden they have this carte blanche permission to do whatever they want in God's name. History is full of really bad leaders, and that was especially true for Paul when he was writing the book of Romans, because the person who was the emperor in Rome at that time was Nero. And to recall the little Spanish that I know, Nero was no bueno. He was not a good dude. He was a really bad tyrannical leader, a terrible guy. He killed his own mom, killed his own mother, was married twice, killed both of his wives. He had a stepbrother that he was worried might try and take the throne from him, so he assassinated him as well. He's also thought to be responsible for the assassination of Peter and Paul. Nero was not a nice guy. He was not a compassionate ruler. It's thought that he burnt down half of the city of Rome to build a new palace for himself, and he used the Christians in Rome as a scapegoat for his destruction. It's also thought that he was brutal in the execution of Christians. He executed them, crucified them, and then lit them on fire in his gardens, in his palace, just to provide some soft glow evening light for his garden. Like, Nero was a bad dude. He's in charge while Paul is writing Romans and writing this passage, submit to your governing leaders. And it's like, wait a minute, you're calling us to submit to Nero? Like, he is the one who is persecuting us. Now, again, unfortunately, sometimes this passage gets plucked from its context and used by Christians to force people into submission. But I think when you look at the flow of what Paul has been saying, right, because you always have to put, always have to put a text within its context. Anytime you pull a text out of context to try and use it for your own whatever, you start to walk on dicey ground. right? But when you put this text within its context, I think the thrust of what Paul is trying to say is simple. Because if you go back to chapter 12, verse 2, he said, don't conform to this world, but be transformed, right? By the renewing of your mind. And we said part of that is living by a different story. Living by a story of one that's about letting go of power and control. Our world is obsessed with power. Like, you don't have to be a top-level CEO or a governing official to be obsessed with power. You can be a parent who is obsessed with power trying to control your kids, right? We love power. And Paul is saying, be transformed by the renewing of your mind, by living by another story, not one of power and control, but through service and submission. Because you'll remember, Philippians 2, he says, Jesus, who himself was not considered, who considered himself, who was God, but didn't consider himself equal with God, made himself nothing to come in the form of a man to serve. And then Paul goes on to say in chapter 12, verse 3 through 14, here's what it looks like to live within the context of community. And then from there he says, this is what it looks like to live towards the community, i.e. the world. And remember, he says, bless those who... A better king, a different king, who's ruling and reigning over all things. And we put our confidence in him, in him alone. And so Paul here, I think, is saying, hey, just be a good citizen. Seek the welfare of your city. And that's the way he ends this passage, because he says in verse 6, this is also why you pay taxes, for the authorities are God's servants who give their full time to governing. Again, there are governing authorities who are good people. There's also governing authorities who are bad people. But verse 7, give to everyone what you owe them. He's essentially saying be fair and be reasonable. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honor, then honor. See, Paul is trying to show that we transform our lives through the renewing of our minds. And what he's saying here is that a renewed mind respects authority. Doesn't mean you have to agree with them all the time, but the call is to respect them. Now, maybe that seems a bit obvious, but the world that we're living in is characterized by disrespect. Like, we are quick to throw mud at people, throw people under the bus, have a slander campaign against somebody just to get what we want and get our way. And the call of Christians is supposed to be a radical lifestyle. And in our world, respect can be radical. Showing respect, especially in the face of new disrespect. And what it demonstrates is that there is a new reality coming. My wife and I lived in Atlanta for a while before we moved up here, and we came to visit her family. My wife is from La Crosse, Wisconsin. We lived in Atlanta. Every few years, we would get up this way for Christmas, and it was 2010. It was Christmas 2010. We went to go visit my wife's family in La Crosse. And at this point in time, Scott Walker was governor. And the news all over Wisconsin was how teachers and the teachers' union were mad at Scott Walker. We were like in a restaurant, and it was like TV screens all over the place. I'm like, Wisconsin does not like Scott Walker, right? Like, having no idea what was going on, living in Atlanta, coming up here, like, wow, there's some serious turmoil. So when I got hired at Meadowbrook, I realized, somebody told me, oh yeah, Scott Walker goes to our church. I was like, really? They're like, oh yeah, he lives in Wauwatosa, just down the street from our church. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. Now, this was his time when he was running for president, and so he wasn't around a whole lot. But I started to think, because there were a lot of educators at our church, and I heard just rumors that it was tough at times for people to be at church with Scott Walker as he's doing all of these things that making it hard for teachers in the teachers union. Again, I don't know the story. I don't know all of what was going on. But what I was starting to think about was like, man, what if you were a teacher in 2010? And you were at school one day, and you were just totally angry about what was happening with the policies that he was making or whatever. And then I thought, what if you were a teacher who went to Meadowbrook Church? and you're in a conversation with this teacher, and this teacher's going on and on and on, and you listen to what that individual says, and you're like, yeah, I get it. Like, I get it. You're frustrated. But you know, he really is a good guy. And that teacher would be like, what are you saying? How can you say he's a good guy? How do you know he's a good guy? Like, well, he goes to my church. I see him most Sundays. We happen to sit in the same pew. We share communion together. He serves. He's faithful. And he's just trying to do what's best. And truth be told, I don't always agree with the things that he does. But he's a good guy, and I love him like a brother. Like, that would blow people's minds. Like, our world has no category for disagreeing with somebody, but yet still being able to say, we're family. That bears witness to a new reality. That's the call of following Jesus, of being able to walk a road of love and disagree with people in authority, but still say, but we can show them respect. Because ultimately, what Paul is saying is, again, we are not citizens of this world. A renewed mind understands that your true citizenship isn't here, but it's with Jesus. And that's what Paul says in Philippians chapter 3. He says, our citizenship is in heaven, and we eagerly await a Savior from there, the Lord Jesus Christ, who by the power that enables him to bring everything under his control. Who has the power? Jesus has the power. Those in office may have a little bit, but they don't really have all the power. Jesus has the power. Who has the control? Jesus has control. And he's going to bring everything under his control, and he will transform our lowly bodies so that they will be like his glorious body. We put our hope in him. We put our hope in the day when he will return to make all things new. And as we put our hope in him, it gives us and it empowers us the ability to live a radical lifestyle in the here and now and love people. Love people who are against us, love people who disagree with us, and love people who have a different way of living. And as we do that, we bear witness to the love of God and a new reality that is brought through Jesus Christ. So may you see that your true citizenship is with Christ. And may that free you to respect authority even when you disagree with them. And in doing so, may you bear witness to the reality of another world that's coming.